Thank you very much indeed, and I'm sure many of you will want to take up parts of that wonderful talk later. But Professor Chomsky asked if we could, for some time anyway, talk about the other big part of his intellectual life, the anarcho-syndicalism, etc., and your intellectual views. Before, as a link, do you see a connection between what you have been talking about now and the political views which we call anarcho-syndicalism?
I think one has to be cautious about that. There's no logical connection. Like, one could believe what most psychologists, philosophers, and linguists believe, and have the, which is quite different from this, and have the same political views. That would not be a logical contradiction, and conversely. Nevertheless, there's a kind of an underlying suggestive connection, which actually has historical origins. So there was a time, 18th century, when there were similar basically at the time when classical liberalism emerged, late Enlightenment, Wilhelm von Humboldt, Adam Smith, Rousseau, to an extent, the early Marx. You put this together, there were ideas about the nature of language and the nature of appropriate social systems which were similar. They were based on the conception, goes back to Descartes, was actually the first to formulate it clearly, not the social aspect, he was quite reactionary, but the basic idea that the essential property of humans as distinct from other organisms was a kind of creative capacity which manifested itself most clearly and centrally in language. So there's a kind of Descartes, his criterion for the, everyone knows that Descartes distinguished body and mind. His basic criterion for identifying mind was the ability to use language in the normal creative way. Creative in the sense that we all have the capacity to produce new expressions, new in our experience, new in the history of the language, and to do it in a way which is appropriate to situations, but not caused by situations. So the particular situation, say, that I'm in now, does not cause me to produce the next sentence I'll produce. I could decide to talk about the weather in Boston or something. It wouldn't be appropriate, but I could easily do it, have the capacity. So you can, and you can do this endlessly without limit. And it's true of all humans. You have a capacity for a creative activity not caused by external or internal circumstances, but appropriate to them in some way. That's a total mystery, I should say. It was a mystery in the 17th century. It's a mystery today. It goes beyond standard physical assumptions. Modern physics is based essentially on two principles, determinacy and randomness. Everything that can be accounted for is accounted for either as determinate or random. The same is true of general theory of computation. So those of you who know Turing machine theory, general theory of computation, know that it's either determinate or random. But apparently human intelligence goes beyond that, which is quite mysterious, but it's evident to all of us. We can act creatively in this way, new expressions, appropriate to situations, eliciting, not caused by them, eliciting thoughts in other people which are new to them but which they comprehend. So that's just normal human behavior, totally distinct from anything known in the animal world and not easy to explain in physical terms when you think it through. It's just as mysterious now as it was when it was pointed out in the 17th century. Now, what does this have to do with the way society ought to be organized? Well, the conclusion that was drawn by Rousseau, by Humboldt and others, is that any social system which inhibits human creativity is unacceptable. People should be free to inquire, to create, to realize their own potential, to develop their own creative capacities which are internal to them without external imposition of authority or force or domination. Well, that's the core principle of classical anarchism. It's an outgrowth of classical liberalism. Classical liberalism ran aground on the rise of capitalism. The two are incompatible. Capitalist systems are incompatible with classical liberal ideas. And the residue that persisted is what led to the core of the modern anarchist tradition, sometimes called libertarian socialist tradition. That's the connection. It's not a logical, right? It's a connection of sort of, I don't know what, the spirit or something like that, which was discussed and articulated in the 18th century and has raises some interesting things to think about, including the nature of this creative capacity. What is it? And is it correct that a society that in some way limits, constrains, and controls it is illegitimate? Is it illegitimate to have social structures of any kind that involve authority, domination, hierarchy, coercion? Are these fundamentally illegitimate structures? If they're not, they have to justify themselves somehow. They have a burden of proof. They have to show that they're legitimate. Maybe that can sometimes be done, but that they have the burden of proof. Authority is not self-justifying. And it sort of is rooted in conceptions of human nature of this kind, which were discussed in interesting ways in the 17th and 18th century.
How did you yourself, how did your interest in anarchism begin?
It began in childhood. Actually, the first article that I wrote, that I can remember writing at least, was I can date it exactly, it was February 1939. It was about the fall of Barcelona. And it started by talking about the spread of fascism, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Toledo, Barcelona. Barcelona's the end of the anarchist revolution in Spain. Actually, it had ended earlier, but I didn't know that at the time. About at that time, I began to go hang around anarchist bookstores in New York. There were emigres, Spanish emigres, fleeing from the residue of the revolution. Actually, as I say, I didn't know it at the time, but the revolution had already been destroyed 2 years earlier. It existed in 1936, but it was crushed by the combined efforts of fascists, communists, and liberal democracies. Now, they disagreed on all kind of other things, but they agreed that liberty cannot be tolerated. So it was quite successful, but it was crushed. Now, this doesn't enter much into official history because, you know, the existing systems of power don't like to look at it that way. But I think you can see it. If you read Orwell's Homage to Catalonia, he was in the kind of quasi-Trotskyist militia, PUM militia. So, and as he says, he didn't really understand what the anarchists were doing. He is very honest about that. But he says there was something good about it. He could sense that there was something important happening. And he describes how it was crushed, mainly by communists in May 1937, but with the collaboration of the liberal democracies and of course, the fascists who were supporting Franco. I didn't know that at the time. But, in fact, I didn't read Homage to Catalonia, though it was published already. And there was an interesting reason. It was suppressed. Orwell's British publishers would not permit it. I mean, I think they published a couple of dozen copies or something. It was essentially unknown. It was anti-communist, and that was just not tolerable in the climate of the time. So it only appeared years later as a kind of a Cold War document, anti-communist Cold War document, which I'm sure would have horrified Orwell. It was after his death. So I didn't know that book until much later. But there was a lot of material around, pamphlet literature, left journals, even talk with emigres, which kind of made all of this alive. Later I learned more about it.
You're already into your studies, but did this discovery of anarchy and the excitement that you felt, but did that lead you on a course to action, that you were determined to do something in the largest political arena possible, whether it was the streets or in writing pamphlets or whatever it was? Did that lead you to a course of action that you followed?
It did, but just personally, the main, this was right in the early days of the Second World War. I was a young teenager, so not doing a lot of things politically, but there were lots and lots, there's a wide variety of activist political groups, but I was never able to join any of them because they were all, virtually all of the functioning ones were either kind of mainstream liberal, I wouldn't accept that, to the right, pro-fascist, and they existed, of course, all over, or the so-called left groups were almost entirely Bolshevik. And I was anti-Leninist, strongly anti-Leninist. I thought at the time that the Bolshevik Revolution was the worst disaster that had ever befallen the socialist movement. I still think that. But so it was kind of closed off from direct political participation. And my own personal activism happened to be mostly connected with Palestine. I grew up in a, as you mentioned, in a Jewish environment. My parents were politically kind of Roosevelt Democrats, though much of the family was unemployed Jewish working class, all kinds of political radicalism. I was very much involved in what was then the Zionist movement, it's now called anti-Zionist, efforts to create a binationalist Arab-Jewish working-class-based socialist community in Palestine. It may sound exotic now. It wasn't so strange in the environment at the time. Something like that could have been possible. That was a large part of my own political activism up till 1948, when that ended for obvious reasons.
Can I just ask a couple more questions, because you yourself wanted to bring this in? Can you just say how the your protest at the war in Vietnam played into your, how your views played into that?
Well, the 1950s were pretty quick. I should say in the early 40s, I was very strongly opposed to British imperialism. So one of the moments of, you know, dramatic moments of my own early teenage life was the British invasion of Greece, which I thought was an utter horror story. I wrote about it, talked about it, and so on. But this went on through the 40s. You know, you know what was happening in that period. The 1950s were a pretty quiescent time. Nothing much was happening. There was a lot. It's called McCarthyism, but it was much broader than that. There was a kind of a massive suppression of independent thought, independent action, very much like after the First World War. First World War, the labor movement in the United States was simply wiped out, revived in the 30s, but it was practically destroyed. In the early 50s, a huge assault began against labor. It's pretty well studied in scholarship, and people who lived through it are aware of it. But there was a massive attack to try to undermine the kind of... out of the Second World War came a kind of a radical democratic spirit around the world, all over, and in Europe and in the United States, everywhere. And the first task of the victors, the United States and Britain, was to crush it. In Europe, they had to crush the partisans. The first actions of the British and American armies were to crush the partisan movements, which were basically radical democratic, and that was intolerable. And this was incidentally under the British Labour Party. When the British forces moved up to northern Italy, British and American forces, they discovered a functioning society. The Italian partisans were a strong movement. They had essentially driven out the Nazis. The British and the Americans had to destroy them. They had developed a cooperative functioning society. The British Labour Party was appalled at the fact that workers were managing their own firms without bosses telling them what to do. That was completely unacceptable. And Americans, of course, even more so. So in Italy and Greece, similar things in France, even in Germany. One of the reasons for breaking Germany up into two sections, which is expressed by George Kennan, one of the leading architects of the post-war world, was that it was necessary to wall Western Germany away from the East. Interesting turn of phrase. The problem was that in the East there were radical labor-based movements developing, and the West had to be protected from that. So we had to wall it off from the Eastern influences. This went on all over Europe. And the same was happening at home. So massive assault on labor, and it was a pretty quiescent period. Getting to the Vietnam War, the right time to have become involved in it was early 1950s. And there was just no imaginable way to do it. By 1961, it was becoming much more serious. This is not the normal history. But if you look at the actual facts, when Kennedy came in, John F. Kennedy, in 1961, he very quickly escalated the war sharply. In 1961-62, he authorized the U.S. Air Force to carry out bombing raids in South Vietnam. They did it under South Vietnamese markings. So the planes had South Vietnamese markings, but they were American planes piloted by Americans. The facts kind of dribbled through, but nobody was paying attention. He also authorized napalm, authorized chemical warfare to destroy crops and livestock, began programs to drive the peasants into what amounted to concentration camps called strategic hamlets, where they were surrounded by barbed wire to protect them from the guerrillas who they were supporting. Facts we now know that this was understood from internal documents, but that was the kind of propaganda. It's pretty clear if you looked at it what was going on. So at that point it was possible to begin talking about the war, but in a very narrow way. I mean, the first talks that I was able to give were literally in people's living rooms or in a church with four people, the preacher, the organizer, a drunk who walked in, a guy who wanted to kill me. But that was a typical audience. And this went on for a long time. It's kind of suppressed now, but it's worth knowing. Those of you who are old enough to remember and participate may recall that there was an international day of protest against the war in October 1965. And by that time, South Vietnam had been practically destroyed. North Vietnam was being bombed. There were hundreds of thousands of American troops there, so there was an international day of protest. I lived in Boston. Boston's maybe the most liberal city in the country, or close to it. We thought we would have an outdoor demonstration on the Boston Common. It's essentially Hyde Park, where everything takes place. So there was a march to the Boston Common. I was supposed to be one of the speakers. It was broken up by force, and mostly by students, violently broken up. The liberal press praised those who were breaking up the demonstrations. How dare these, unpatriotic people not support our noble troops, and so on and so forth. The next international day of protest was in March 1966, and we realized we couldn't have an outdoor demonstration to be broken up. So it was in a church. The church was attacked. A lot of police around, couldn't do anything, and so on. It was only 67, 68, that you really began to get protest. In England, it was worse, incidentally. The person who was really running pretty much the international anti-war movement, and especially in England, was Peggy Duff, who some of you may recall, wonderful person. She had to bring in speakers from the United States to give talks to demonstrations in England. I came a couple of times. I.F. Stone came a couple of times. And nobody wanted to say anything here, practically. And this went on for a long time, same elsewhere. I mean, there's all kind of illusions that have been created about it. But it was quite a while before things really took off.
Can I come in now? Because there's a-